Welcome to the Aporia podcast. Remember, you can listen to this podcast on all the major platforms. If you like the show, you'll love the Aporia magazine. Find the link in the show notes, along with our Twitter and a link to the bonus questions we ask our guests.
Alex, what's the worst thing that the Manosphere says?
The worst thing that the Manosphere says? Oh, that's a hard one. You're going to hit me with a hard one right off the bat. Anytime it's just open like that. Well, I think something that has bugged me about the Manosphere kind of up to this point, as far as like the worst thing, is when it comes to evolutionary psychology, taking kind of the dual mate hypothesis and applying this across the board as if every woman is going to immediately leave a man and pursue a short-term mating strategy as soon as she has the opportunity to do so.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain a bit more about the dual mate?
Sure. So this is also called strategic pluralism, and it's the idea that human beings, men and women both, have a dualistic mating strategy where we can pursue individuals for long-term mating or short-term mating. And long-term mating would be committed relationships, fewer sexual partners, also kind of related to a slower life history strategy. Short-term mating, basically casual sex, many more sexual partners. Typically, within the context of evolutionary psychology, the idea is that this would secure the genes of a good sire, whereas long-term mating might secure the resources of a good sire. But there's a lot of nuance there, and there's a lot of overlap. For example, most mates that are selected as long-term mates are also selected based on qualities that would indicate good genes, like physical attractiveness being kind of at the top of that. So I think this idea that these are two distinct strategies, that, you know, a woman will pursue a man just because she wants his resources, and then the moment that she gets the opportunity, she's going to cheat on him with someone for a short-term strategy to get his genes or something. That's not really well supported in the research. It's kind of a bastardization of the actual hypothesis.
So can you tell me why that became popular in the Manosphere, and also how it was debunked?
Absolutely, sure. So I think this became popular in the Manosphere because of it lends itself well to this idea of alphas and betas, which I think kind of reflect archetypes and experiences that people have. Like, certainly we see across society that there are some people in leadership positions, there are some people that are down at the bottom of the social hierarchy. We see, you know, that some people are tall and they're physically attractive and they're strong, and other people are short and they're not, and that sort of thing. So it's kind of easy to categorize a lot of things we see in life into kind of a binary, like, okay, an alpha and a beta, or omega, or whatever you want to call it, something like that.
A sigma male, that's the new thing.
A sigma male, yeah. So yeah, it's branching out now. Now we have all kinds of Greek letter males. So originally this was the dual mate hypothesis of ovulatory shifts, and this is related to the idea that women can pursue a mating strategy where it's a long-term partner who is primarily a resource provider, but to maximize fitness, to secure the good genes, they can cheat during the period when they're fertile, which is why it was called the hypothesis of ovulatory shifts, to secure the genes of basically a better sire in that case. So they have the provider on the one hand, and then the good gene sire on the other hand. A lot of this research has not borne out. I think a lot of the idea that mating preferences shift during ovulation has not been able to replicate. But then in addition to that, we see very, very low rates of extra pair paternity. So it doesn't really seem to be the case in the genetic record or in modern environment or whatever the case may be, that this is really a thing, that women are seeking out, you know, extra pair partners for the good genes, and then raising, you know, raising the child with the cuckold or something like that.
Obviously, you're very active on Twitter, and you do these wonderful threads debunking some of these, or just perhaps exploring the nuance of the Manosphere. I don't even want to call it like discourse. How do people who identify as coming from that red pill pickup artist Manosphere community, how do they respond when you do such things? I mean, maybe that particular myth being debunked, what do they say?
Yeah, I think it depends on the individuals, because certainly it's not a homogenous mix of people that call themselves red pilled, or especially the Manosphere is not a homogenous group, you know, I should say even further. But yeah, some of their reactions are very positive, and then other reactions are very negative. And I think that depends how ideologically immersed people are within it, and like the extent to which they are fans of perhaps influencers within the Manosphere. Certainly, you know, people will call you names and that sort of thing, a feminist or whatever the case may be. But, you know, almost all of my criticisms of the Manosphere, something like that, have been from the perspective of evolutionary psychology. They've been very specific niche things, like, this is what you guys got wrong about the psychology of mating, basically.
Do you think you're seen as an ally, more of an ally, or more of an enemy of this research by perhaps the, let's do first the key figures, like a Rich Cooper type person, and then the general followers of such people.
More of an ally or more of a foil to them?
Yeah.
Huh, I don't know. Probably to some extent more of, it's hard to even say for sure. I would say more of an ally in some sense. I think for anyone that is interested in the psychology of mating, evolutionary psychology, probably more of an ally. Anyone that is perhaps more interested in pickup artistry and being angry at women, definitely against that. Because certainly something I've talked about a lot is, you know, the extent to which a lot of manosphere discourse and ideology is basically just driven by anger at women. And mm-hmm. and if that's the case, yeah, I mean, as someone who's just not angry at women and who tells people on a regular basis, like, you know, you can't have good relationships if you hate the whole opposite sex. Yeah, if that's the, you know, perspective that they're coming from, which is just like the gender or the sex war or something, yeah, they're going to not like me very much.
Yeah, it's interesting because you occupy this middle ground. And people in the middle tend to be shot at from both sides, right? Like there's always, for every reaction, there's a reaction, and then you're kind of placing yourself, I guess, in this nuanced position. Okay, so first question was the worst thing. What is the best thing they tend to say? What, like, genuinely good advice that actually is quite aligned with the literature?
Sure. So I think genuinely good advice in the manosphere is probably related to self-improvement and specifically fitness. You know, they tell men that they need to lift and that they need to work on their physical appearance. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very well supported in the literature that, you know, physical size, musculature is attractive to women. It's associated with even higher relationship satisfaction. It's pretty much always a net gain. Like, you know, if a man goes from being fat to healthy, if he goes from being like really skinny to a little bit more jacked, there's like no downside to that. So that's very basic advice that I would kind of agree with. And I think anything to do with like maximizing one's physical appearance or attractiveness as well is going to be a big one in that case. Because again, the literature is very consistent. Yeah, and like attractiveness is a thing. And, you know, people select attractive mates. So anything, you know, that you know is going to make you more attractive physically is going to be an asset to you.
So do you think it's cope when some of these people who might be closer to the incel community, although far from all of them, say things like, well, actually, women are much more interested in things like sense of humor or status, how much money you have. Because I've seen from some of your threads that actually they're also quite interested in attractiveness and facial symmetry. Like, is it overstating it to say that women really aren't that interested in attractiveness?
Yeah, to say that women are not that interested in attractiveness is definitely overstating it. Probably a good line of research on this is speed dating studies where, you know, people are brought into a room, they're put in a circle, and then they interact, you know, man on woman for about 5 minutes with each person. Very consistently across this research, the best predictor of who gets selected for a second date, and these people can date and meet in real life through these studies, which is kind of a cool methodology, is physical attractiveness, both for men and women. We see similar things on dating apps, you know, more attractive physically profiles, mm-hmm. they get much more attention, again, both men and women. So physical attractiveness is prioritized pretty highly, at least as far as what's called like zero contact, right? Like someone that you don't know or anything like that. Yeah. Like who are you going to approach? Who are you going to give your phone number to? Someone that you've never met, someone that you like physically. But then after that point, yeah, all of the other things come into play. So there's, I think the incel community also overstates it if they downplay the role of personality and behavior, because those are also huge. But at the same time, whatever the opposite of that is, it says like, oh, women don't care about attractiveness. Yeah, they do.
Isn't there like a Louis C.K. joke, I don't know if it's him, where he says, you know, what the difference is between sexual harassment and, you know, a successful pickup is, are you ugly?
Yeah. And I mean, that, you know, that's something I need to look into a little bit more. You know, I ran a survey asking about approaches and that sort of thing. And we asked, you know, a large majority of women said that they wish they were approached more in person. Mm. You know, it was something upwards of 70 or 80% for women between like 18 and 30. And then for older women, actually a little bit lower. But so young women are saying, men are not approaching me much, and I want to be approached more. And certainly a great deal of the feedback I received on that from the incel community is basically like, no, they don't want to be approached by unattractive men. They're saying that because they're imagining an attractive man in their mind. And is this true? I don't know. We can't know from the research that I did in that case. Maybe, maybe not, but it's worth looking into further.
Okay, so you are obviously a high-value man. You're well-educated, you're intelligent, you dress well, you're in great physical condition. I'm not flirting with you. We're just stating objective reality. And I imagine that you're confident, you've had success with women. It probably comes quite easy to you. What, like how do men approach women? And especially in this day and age, perhaps you're in the office, a stranger on the street, do you have any like go-to advice?
Well, certainly there's, you know, the whole kind of cold approach thing, which, you know, I think when people think about approach, I think that's what instantly pops into their mind from like PUA influence.
To listen to the full podcast, become a subscriber at aporiamagazine.com.